Hopefully, you're excited to hearing about Hosea. I don't know how much you know about the book of Hosea. I'm not sure if you've even read the whole book before. It's actually 14 chapters. It's longer than you expect for a minor prophet hidden away in the Bible. Not sure how much you know about where it fits in the Bible and where it fits in God's salvation story. So what I want us to do today is, before we zoom in and look at Hosea and what this book has to tell us, we're actually going to zoom all the way back out and look at where Hosea fits in God's salvation plan. That image there, which I'm sure your eyesight is excellent, so you can see every detail of that picture behind me, is also printed out, and you might have got one when you came through the door. It's a little helpful Bible overview. Because the Bible isn't a random collection of stories. The Bible is actually God's big salvation story, all in one. And every book of the Bible is like a little piece of the puzzle to help us understand how it all fits together. Now, I will admit to you, doing puzzles is not my thing. Something about all those little pieces, for some reason, kind of freaked me out a little bit. So you won't find me doing a puzzle on my day off. However, putting the Bible together and seeing how the Bible fits together is one story and one puzzle that I love doing. So let's do that now. Let's zoom out. You thought you were going to come and hear about Hosea, but we're actually going to hear about the whole Bible today. So let's zoom out and see the story so far before we get to Hosea. So strap in. The story obviously starts in the beginning. In Genesis, God creates Adam and Eve and this beautiful world, and he made Adam and Eve in his own image. They had a special place to live and a special relationship with God, and he knew them, they knew him, they were loved by him, and it was good. But sadly, that relationship and that beautifulness didn't last long because they broke their relationship with God, and in their unfaithfulness to him, they didn't trust him, but instead, in trusting in his goodness for them and his goodness himself, they listened and trusted and obeyed the serpent. And there's consequences to breaking relationships. And Adam and Eve's consequences were big. They're consequences that we feel today. Because people who had been unfaithful to God can't actually continue to live with God, and so were cast out of God's presence. God and people's relationship was broken. And also, the relationship between people themselves was also broken in the process. So Genesis 3:3, you'll see lots of Bible verses flashing up, just so you don't have to kind of find them yourself. God banished them from the Garden of Eden to work the ground which they had been taken. But God's love overwhelms. He works out a way for his justice and his mercy to redeem the relationship with people and to make them his own again. He starts with a man called Abram, who becomes Father Abraham. You'll notice that God has a habit of changing people's names. When there's a significant event or purpose or something that God has for this person to do, he'll change their name. God promises to Abraham that he is going to have a special place to live. He will have a family so large that it won't be able to be counted. He will be blessed and he will bring a blessing to the whole world. He promises Abraham that he will be his God. And this promise is one we're going to hold on to all day through Hosea. In Genesis 12, I'm going to read this one for us, 1-3. It says, "The Lord had said to Abram, 'Go from your country and from your people and your father's household, and to the land that I show you. I will make you a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the people of the earth will be blessed through you.' And a little bit later, God came back to Abram and said, he took him outside and he said, 'Look up to the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.' Abram believed the Lord, and it was accredited to him as righteousness. Genesis 15:8 says that on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, and he said, "To your descendants I will give this land." See how God is making all of these promises to this one man who becomes Father Abraham. This is how it started. One man, one older couple who had one son and then two grandsons. Not exactly a speedy start to growing a nation so big that you can't count them, but God is faithfully working. Abraham and Sarah, you'll see their family tree behind them, had Isaac, who married Rebecca. Nice little story about a matchmaking there at the watering hole with camels. And then Rebecca had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau, who had a troubled relationship where that started way back in the womb where they wrestled together. But God chose the younger son, Jacob, to carry on this family line. And then Jacob, we're getting some momentum here, finally has 12 sons. He has 12 sons, sadly to a troubled relationship between two sisters. And Jacob, really significantly, wrestles with God. He wrestles with God and wants God to bless him. And in this wrestle with God, God says, "Not only will I bless you, but now, Jacob, you are going to become known as Israel." So again, Jacob's name gets changed to Israel, which is significant as we look at Jacob's 12 sons. They become the nation of Israel. So the sons of Jacob, the sons of Israel, the nation of Israel. Broken relationships continue, though, however, between these brothers. Sadly, they even try to kill one of their youngest brothers, Joseph. And he ends up in Egypt. Well, this story might be familiar to a lot of us. He ends up in Egypt and in a place of high power. And so when the rest of his family, who thought that he was dead, end up in Egypt because of a famine and need help, they end up in front of their brother, who they didn't know was even alive. And so when they face Joseph, he reminds them that despite what they had done, God is in control. He says to them in Genesis 50:20, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." God is in control. It's in Egypt that these 12 brothers reunite, and then their families start to grow, and this nation starts to grow and grow and grow. Because Joseph was initially accepted in Egypt, so was his whole family, the whole nation now of Israel. But as the years went on and that Pharaoh that knew Joseph died, then a new Pharaoh came to power. But while that came to power, the nation of Israel kept growing and growing and growing. And then this new Pharaoh got scared. He thought, "This nation is now so big and they're living right here with us. What if they actually start to try and overpower us?" And so before they could overpower the Egyptians, the Egyptian Pharaoh said, "We're going to make them our slaves." And so the Israel nation was enslaved in Egypt. And this slavery was hard and it went on for many, many years. And they cried out to God to rescue them. They were God's people under Father Abraham, but they weren't in the right place and they were slaves in Egypt. So God hears their cries, and in Exodus 6, he sends Moses to save them. He says, "Therefore say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out of the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm, with a mighty axe of judgment. I will make you my own people, and I will be your God." Just like he said to Abraham. "Then you will know that I am the Lord, who brought you out of the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land that I swore at a lifted hand to your father to give Abraham, to give Isaac and Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord." This is an amazing promise that they're given while in slavery. It takes Pharaoh 10 signs for him to finally let God's people go, so that God could rescue his people, just as he promised Moses, and take them out to meet him on a mountain to rescue his people so that they could worship him. And it's on this mountain where we get a very significant covenant. In Exodus 19, it says, "You yourselves have seen what I did in Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings, and I brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation." These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and he summoned the elders of the people and he set before them the words of the Lord had commanded him to speak. And the people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. So God saves them, and then he shows them how to live as his people. In Exodus 20, he gives them the Ten Commandments to show them what it means to be his people. Their faithfulness to God and Moses, however, sadly did not last long. They were so impatient for Moses to come back down from delivering the message to God that they thought that he might never come back. And so they went to Aaron and said, "Aaron, can you make us some gods so that we can worship?" And then Aaron did. Heartbreaking as it was, Aaron said to them, "Take off your gold earrings, or that all your wives have and your sons and your daughters are wearing, and bring them to me." And so all the people took off their earrings and they brought them to Aaron, and he took them and he handed them to him, and he made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf and fashioning it with a tool. Then he said, "These are your gods who brought you out of Egypt." People are hardwired to worship. And if we're not worshiping God, then we look for something else to worship. And that's what happened at the foot of that mountain. It's so hard to read. When you read it so quickly together, you can see God's faithful hand and his unfaithfulness of his people. We know that it was not these golden calves that brought them out of Egypt. It was God. God who remembered his covenant and he brought them through his promises that he had given them to their father Abraham. Moses punishes the people for their great sin. But then he also goes to God and pleads to God that God would be merciful to the people who had been unfaithful, and that God would remember his promises to their father Abraham, and because of God's faithful promises and God's faithful character, that he would have mercy on the people. And God does. God takes his people to the land that he had promised them, and he calls them again to be faithful to me, to not to worship other gods, because there's a lot of nations around you and they have other gods. Don't be distracted by them, he said. Particularly, don't intermarry with these other nations, or otherwise they will bring their gods and their practice of worship into your nation and they will distract you and you will be led off to worship these other nations. God reminds them to be faithful to me, who has been faithful to you. But the people struggled. They struggled because they didn't have leaders who would remember to be faithful themselves. And after lots of struggles with leaderships and judges who didn't lead the people very well, finally, eventually, God gave the people their most famous king, King David. And finally, under David, there was a king who says he had a man after God's own heart. And the kingdom was finally in a place where they could build in prosperity, they could grow, and they could live in peace, worshipping God. His son Solomon, however, who is ironically known for being very wise and also being very foolish, didn't remember the warnings that God had said. And he did exactly what God said not to do. And he intermarried with lots of people from, lots of wives from many different nations. And his wives, just as God had warned, led him to fully worship their gods instead of the one true God. The king was now not leading the people. This great time of peace that Israel had had was now overcome by trouble and leadership squabbles. So King Solomon was succeeded by his son, Rehoboam, who extended Solomon's building project to breaking point and crushed the people. So there was a rebellion led by Jeroboam. And now Solomon's kingdom splits into two. We've got the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. You'll notice here in the slide which has both the kingdoms on it, that the northern kingdom has most of the team, doesn't it? Most of the nation of Israel, 10 of the tribes, in fact. And the southern kingdom, this tiny little kind of southern kingdom. The northern kingdom is where we're going to picture most of our time is happening today in Hosea. Hosea is a prophet that is sent to the northern kingdom. You'll notice that this northern kingdom, because they're the biggest, I think, and when you've got most of the brothers together, they keep the family name. So they continue to be called Israel. Northern kingdom, they keep being called Israel. But because also, you know, names are flexible, as we've just discovered, they also get referred to as Ephraim and sometimes Samaria, which is the land that they were living. So when you hear Israel, from now on in Hosea, when you hear Israel, Ephraim, or even Samaria, you're thinking that northern kingdom, okay? When you hear the southern kingdom, they were called Judah or Jerusalem, which was the city that they had in their area. But Israel and Ephraim, same place. Ez, Aaron May, same person. It'll all help. King Jeroboam, he didn't want his tribes in the north to go down into the southern kingdom to worship God in Jerusalem, where they were meant to worship God. And so, breaks our heart, what does he do? He makes two golden calves. He puts one at Dan in the north and one at the kingdom of Bethel in the south. And he says, here you go, Israel, here are your gods and you can worship them to the north and to the south, but we don't go down to Jerusalem into the southern kingdom. Again with the golden calves, again with worshipping things that are not their God. It was a turbulent time in this northern kingdom. It wasn't a place of prosperity. There was change of leadership after change of leadership, and not the kind of gentle voting kind, but the coup d'etat, bloodshed, war kind of change of leadership. Through bloodshed over again and again, different kings took power. In fact, five kings followed the King Jeroboam. There was lots of idolatry in the northern kingdoms. And none of these kings that came into power took their nation back to worshipping God and away from idols. But they remained worshipping these golden calves and to the gods around them in the other nations. I'm going to throw a bunch of names of kings at you here. Don't be overwhelmed. They'll come together at the end. There was a significant king, King Omri, who established his rule, and it was one really just characterized as wickedness and cruelty. His son, Ahab, wanted to then take over a vineyard at some point because he thought that would be a really good place to have a palace, and this was in a town called Jezreel. Now, Ahab, to get this vineyard where he wanted to build his palace, he just falsely accused the owner of this vineyard of doing something that he shouldn't have done, and then had him murdered, essentially. This type of power and corruption became how the kingdom in the north worked. And this abuse of power is what the Israelites were living under. You can read about this in 1 Kings in 21. Ahab's wife was Jezebel, and her name was synonymous with idolatry and spiritual adultery. Effectively, she made the worship of Baal the national religion for this kingdom. Baal was a fertility god of the Canaanites, who were one of the nations that lived nearby them. And he was opposed by the prophets Elijah and Elisha. You might remember a big standoff between Elijah at Mount Carmel and the prophets of Baal. So, amazing story of God showing that he is the true God. But the people lived under this treadmill of bad kings. It continued until God raised up an army officer called Jehu to bring down the house of Omri, Omri and all of his sons that followed. Jehu, though, he took his power with great bloodshed. And he went to Ahab's palace in Jezreel. And just as Ahab had built that palace in bloodshed, he took it in bloodshed. So that town of Jezreel became known as the town or the place of bloodshed. For four generations, Jehu reigned over with his sons, Joash, Jehoahaz, and Jeroboam. I'm probably saying them wrong and I apologize to them. But these guys were little better than the kings that came before them. They said, we're not meant to worship Baal, but instead they placed Baal worship with other idolatry worship, which kind of meandered on for a little while until Baal worship came back, even bigger than ever, as the national religion of this northern kingdom. Jeroboam ruled for 40 years, which after a really long time of turbulence and leadership change is a long time of peace and prosperity. It almost felt like the golden age back of King David. But the difference was, even though there was peace and prosperity in living in the kingdom, the people were far from God. Now here is where God chose to speak. You might have a bit of whiplash because we've just done a lot of history of the Bible all in one hit. But this is the point where Hosea the prophet is asked to go to his people. If you've got this sheet of paper here, then you'll see we are right here in the middle. You'll see that Hosea is, don't read too much, you'll get a bit of a spoiler alert for what's going to happen next. But you'll see Hosea is featured as speaking to the northern kingdom. Hosea comes to a place that has spiritual complacency and complete unfaithfulness to the God who brought them into this land. And nearby, there's this grumbling Assyrian empire which is slowly and quietly growing in power nearby. And Hosea comes to this people, to this nation, to bring the word of the Lord who they had forgotten. Now, Hosea is not just a historical account. We're not just sitting here listening to a history account. But Hosea is written as a poetical account. An account where we will not only get to hear the words of God, but we will actually get to see the heart of God up close and personal today. So Aileen's going to come back for us, and she's going to read for us Hosea 1 to 3. We're going to look at what actually the prophet Hosea has to say to us today. And then we're going to zoom in and find out what's happening. Thanks.
So let's read together the first three chapters of Hosea. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go, marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her. For like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. In that day I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel. Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call her Lo-Ruhamah, which means not loved. For I will no longer show love to Israel, that I should at all forgive them. Yet I will show love to Judah, and I will save them. Not by bow, sword, or battle, or by horses or horsemen, but I, the Lord their God, will save them. After she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. Then the Lord said, call him Lo-Ammi, which means not my people. For you are not my people, and I am not your God. Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called children of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will come together. They will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved one. Rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife and I am not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. Otherwise I will strip her naked and make her as bare as on the day she was born. I will make her like a desert, turn her into a parched land and slay her with thirst. I will not show my love to her children because they are the children of adultery. Their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived them in disgrace. She said, I will go after my lovers who give me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my olive oil and my drink. Therefore, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers, but not catch them. She will look for them, but not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my husband as at first, for then I was better off than now. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and the oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore I will take away my grain when it ripens, and my new wine when it is ready. I will take back my wool and my linen, intended to cover her naked body. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals, her new moons, her Sabbath days, all her appointed festivals. I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were pay from her lovers. I will make them a thicket, and wild animals will devour them. I will punish her for the day she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after her lovers. But me she forgot, declares the Lord. Therefore, I am now going to allure her. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back her vineyards and will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me or my master. I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds in the sky, and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever, I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. In that day I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the skies, and they will respond to the earth, and the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine, and the olive oil, and they will respond to Jezreel. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved one. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. The Lord said to me, go, show your love to your wife again. Though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress, love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethek of barley. Then I told her, you are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way toward you. For the Israelites will live many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days.
Thanks, Aileen. I'm not a beautiful reader, but you are, so thank the Lord for you. Well, that's Hosea 1 to 3. This is what we're going to be zooming into this morning. I hope you could hear the poetic language that we're going to be reading as we go through Hosea. I'm going to start off with a question, though, for you, which is, what is the status of the relationship with God and Israel? What is the relationship status of God and Israel is something that we're going to be looking at for the next 15 minutes or so as we zoom in on the book of Hosea. As we read Hosea, God doesn't just tell us things about us, but he shows us things about himself. And these chapters that we just read, that Aileen just read so beautifully, they actually have a lot of things in them that are quite confronting. They may not be what you'd expected when you thought we're going to hear a prophet speak about God. You might have expected the prophet to come and declare things, but instead of God first telling his prophet to say things, he first tells him to go and do something. He first says to Hosea to go and to get married and make a family. God knows that a picture is worth a thousand words, and so he wants to give us a picture of what his prophet is about to say before he says anything at all. He does this a lot, actually, with his prophets. He gets them to act out prophecy before they tell the people what it's about. If you've ever read Ezekiel, you would have seen that he does a lot of this. He does it with also his prophet Elijah, and he even does it with John the Baptist, getting them to act out something so that people understand what they're about to say. And so, what is the picture of Hosea's family trying to tell us today? Why is God using this picture to help us? Because as we zoom in and as we look on this marriage of Hosea and Gomer, interestingly, we've seen that Hosea is not told to marry a specific person, but he's actually told to marry a person with a specific character. And oddly, a promiscuous character. You might actually have a different version of the Bible on your lap, and it might translate it as actually a wife of whoredom or a wife of harlotry. These are weighty words. But all of these words have at their center the same sense of unfaithfulness and untrustworthy, a disloyal character, one that is prone to wander. Hosea is told to marry a wife whose character is unfaithful. And this is not what we would call solid marriage advice at all, is it? In fact, it's actually the opposite of exactly what we would say. Because we know that in marriage, that at its core, it requires faithfulness. Many of us know the pain of unfaithfulness when this is broken in marriage. And so why does God ask his prophet Hosea to go and do this? Well, God doesn't leave us wondering. He tells us in verse 2. You'll see it come up on the screen. Go and marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her. For like an adulterous wife, the land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. It's actually not going to be on the screen because I said we'll have Hosea on our laps. So I just put verses on the screen that are outside of Hosea. I apologize. But this is what God says. He says, go and marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her, for like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord, to me. Gomer's promiscuous, unfaithful character represents Israel's promiscuous, unfaithful character. I wonder what this picture of Hosea's adulterous wife makes you feel. Do you feel angry at Gomer or empathy for Hosea as you look at this marriage? Do you start to feel a sense of sadness or injustice or a desire for justice? I do want to pause here though for a minute because we can't rush over this picture of adultery. And I know that this will hit us all differently. Sitting here today, you might be actually feeling a bit removed from things that are happening. And I do want you to take time to pause and to think about this picture of unfaithfulness in a personal and intimate way that we're being shown here. This is unfaithfulness in the most closest relationship there is. But if you're sitting here today and this picture is actually hitting quite close to home for you, you know that unfaithfulness in marriage doesn't come without a lot of hurt. And you're right. And so if this picture is bringing up for you pain and it's threatening to make it feel overwhelming at the moment, then can I just say to you, my friend, please just stay with me. Breathe with me as we look at this picture here that God is showing us. We'll see why he's showing us this particular picture which comes with such great pain. Let's see first what God is saying about himself. And then we'll understand how we can trust and apply that to ourselves and our lives. Hosea is obedient to God. He doesn't object. Can you give us a little blank slide? Because I keep looking at that question that's distracting me. Thank you so much. Hosea is obedient to God. He doesn't object, but he goes and he marries Gomer, a wife with a promiscuous character. And he has children with her. And the names of these children are also weighty. They help us also understand this picture that God is showing us here too. The children who so naturally possess the character of their mother are given specific names, and these names have very specific meanings. We meet Jezreel, Lo Ruhamah, and Lo Amin. Now, I've never named any children. I haven't had that privilege. I did offer to name my brother's third child once. I thought his wife had one, he could have one, I could do the third. He didn't take me up on that offer, strangely. But I have named my two dogs. In fact, I renamed them when I adopted them. Don't judge me. If you want to know what their old names were, come talk to me at morning tea and then you'll understand. But because I adopted them both at the same time, what was really important to me was that their names went well together when I was calling them and talking about them. And so I would sit there and I would kind of say two names together. Frankie and Lola is where I landed. You can also let me know later if you thought I did okay. But Frankie and Lola, I think, are nicely together. But it wasn't until reading Hosea that I started to wonder, what does Frankie and Lola's names mean? And so I did what anyone would do, and I quickly got on the internet and I looked it up. Frankie, I was pleased to find out means honest and truthful. And if you met my dog Frankie, she's pretty honest and truthful and quite free with her emotions. And so I think it's actually a quite good description of Frankie. Lola, though, it turns out means Lady of Sorrow, which was not such a warm, fuzzy kind of meaning to her name, and actually not a good description of my dog Lola at all. So I did what any normal person would do, and I just kept scrolling on the internet to find a better description of her name. I thought, I don't like that meaning, I'll find another meaning. And I found one. So Lola, if you're wondering, means lots of love and affection. It's actually a very good description of my dog Lola, I promise. But I know that that's not actually how it works. I know that you're not meant to choose the name and then make up the meaning that you like to fit that name. That's not what God did here. That's not what he did here with Hosea's children. He gave them the meaning, the name that fitted the meaning that he wanted to tell us. His first son was called Jezreel. At first you might think, that's not a bad sounding name. Jez, I think that's a great name. But in Hosea's day, because we've just done this Bible overview, we would be able to recognise that Jezreel is also pronounced bloodshed. Remember that story that we just read? A little bit like how names can become so synonymous with each other because of events. Maybe you might remember the Watergate scandal that happened. Even if you are sitting here today and you weren't born in the 1970s when it happened, so you definitely don't remember the Watergate scandal, the political scandal in the US, you might have still understand that the word Watergate is scandalous. That name goes together. In fact, the word gate now can be added onto the end of a lot of other words to mean the scandal of. So not that long ago in France, when there were some people trying to pass off some very unfancy wine as fancy wine, it became this whole kind of problem in the wine industry in France, which a lot of us probably haven't heard of, but it became known as Winegate. And you're like, oh, well, you say Winegate, and I think, oh, scandal to do with wine. That's all I need to know. Or a little bit closer to home, in an office that I was working in, when somebody started filling the Dilma tea box with Tetley tea, it became known as Teagate. And it was definitely a scandal. But Watergate makes us think of scandal, the same that Jezreel would have made the Israelites think of bloodshed. You hear Jezreel, you hear bloodshed. The next two children are Lo Ruhamah and Lo Ami. And it's actually a slightly ambiguous whether these next two children are Hosea's children. It doesn't say that he conceived a son to her again like it did with their first, but it just says she conceives again. And as we know, that might fit with the unfaithful character of his wife. It's a little bit ambiguous for us, but these two names mean, Lo Ruhamah means not loved, and their second son, Lo Ami, means not my people. So the children pictured in this family that God wants us to understand, in this marriage, is bloodshed, not loved, not my people. These are unpleasant and confronting names, aren't they? They're painting a picture for us. God is trying to show us something that he needs us to understand, that he needed the Israelites to understand. It's a warning and it's a description. The results of an unfaithful marriage, the consequences of adultery, is seen in this family. God is showing that he will bring bloodshed. And there's a time of judgment that is coming. This time, the judgment's not going to be on King Ahab like it originally was, who stole Jezreel to make it his own palace. But this is going to be on all the kings, as in the whole nation of Israel. I'm not just judging one bad king, but judging the whole nation for their unfaithfulness and their guilt in their unfaithfulness to God. God's unfaithful people will be judged. God tells us the people of Israel are not loved and not his people. He will no longer show them love and no longer forgive them and no longer call them his people because they have rejected and been unfaithful to him. And this is no small thing. This is tragic. I wonder what the picture of Hosea's children makes you feel now. Does it make you feel hurt or anxious or scared? Does it make you feel empathy for actually God's hurt that we're starting to understand? Or is it actually making you feel just a little bit nervous of hearing about God's judgment? How does this help us understand the picture that God is showing us? We've got a marriage, an adulterous wife, and a reconciliation. This might sound a little bit strange, language talking about God and his people in a marriage. I understand it actually is a little bit strange, but God hasn't chosen this picture lightly, but he's chosen this picture intentionally. And actually, it's the same image and the same language that God uses throughout the whole Bible for us to understand the exclusive and intimate relationship with him and his people. And we see that all the way to the end. Do you remember back at Mount Sinai when Moses led the people to make a covenant with God? God had rescued them from Egypt and he'd showed them what it means to live as his people. And then this covenant was a promise of an exclusive relationship between God and Israel. It was like a marriage promise, a marriage covenant. This covenant, though, the husband and the wife, Israel had forgotten. They had forgotten their identity as God's wife. They'd forgotten their relationship status as married. And instead, they'd given their love and their trust to others, other gods and other political alliances, anything else around them except the God who had rescued them. Israel's adultery was idolatry. And it's really sad to see that they were misunderstanding and forgetting who they were and the blessings that God had given them. In Hosea chapter 2, verse 2, it says this. It says, "Rebuke your mother. Rebuke her, for she is not my wife. I am not her husband. And let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts." God is pleading with Israel. The word rebuke here can also be translated as plead. He's pleading with Israel to remember who you are. The next bit here, it could also be better translated as, she is not acting like my wife. I plead that you would put away your adulterous look and your actions, her attempts to attract love from others in her unfaithfulness. Aren't these just actually the words that you can imagine Hosea saying to his wife, Gomer? Pleading with her to stop putting on jewelry to attract other men, but to remember that he is her husband and to be faithful to him. Picture this marriage, this adulterous wife. It's very hurtful, isn't it? What does this picture show us? It shows us that like Gomer, Hosea's unfaithful wife, Israel has been unfaithful to God. They have forgotten who God is and what he has done for them in the past, and forgotten their identity as his people. They're not living faithfully. They're acting like they're single when they're actually married. Jump down to 2 verse 8. It says, "She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain and the wine and the new oil, who lavished her with silver and gold, which she used for Baal." How insulting. Instead of acknowledging the way that God has provided for them, they attribute the things that God has given them to the pagan god Baal. And then they take those things and they use those things to worship this pagan god. Like an unfaithful wife, the people have taken the gifts of their husband and they've given them to their lover, along with their love and their trust and their praise to their lover. And like Gomer, Israel has a promiscuous character, constantly looking for something else or someone else to put her love and trust in. It's not the first time that we've seen this unfaithfulness in Israel. We saw it when we just did this Bible overview, didn't we? We saw it so quickly before Moses had even come down from the mountain that they were looking for something to worship. In fact, this picture here that we have of Hosea's marriage, we can see that sin of adultery and idolatry really matters. Sin is not only breaking God's law, but sin is also breaking God's heart. Israel's covenant with God is a relational covenant. It's promises to show their relationship status. And so the consequences that come from this adultery, the children pictured in this marriage show us bloodshed, not my people, and not loved. The consequences which come from idolatry, like a wronged husband, God judges justly the acts of the unfaithfulness. And in fact, he must judge. He must for him to be just. In chapter 2, verse 14, it shows us that God says, I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals and decked herself with rings and jewelries and went after lovers, but me she forgot, declares the Lord. We've got here a picture of a marriage and an adulterous wife. But judgment isn't the whole picture here, is it? The picture of Hosea's marriage is also a reconciliation. I think if we were watching the movie version of Hosea's life right now, if we were watching the kind of Hallmark kind of something you go to the cinema to see, although nobody goes to the cinema anymore, something you'd stream online to see, then we would see the picture of Hosea's life like this. After Hosea's marriage had fallen apart and after the adultery, then Hosea would leave Gomer. He would move back to probably his childhood town, and there he would find his old rundown cabin that his family used to kind of holiday in. And then we'd have a scene of a montage of Hosea rebuilding this cabin and working through his hurt as he rebuilds his heart. And it would finish the cabin, and then maybe he'd reconnect with his high school sweetheart, and then he would start afresh. We can actually picture that. That's not a hard thing for us to understand. I think that that movie version shows something quite realistic, that after heartbreak, there can be hope. But God doesn't act as we would act. He doesn't make the story as we would. God is actually more shocking than that. In chapter 3, as Aileen read, we go back to the picture of Hosea's family after Hosea had had his wife be unfaithful to him. And we are told that God tells him to go and to redeem your adulterous wife and to make a renewed marriage covenant with her. Have a look at chapter 3 with me. It's one of the shortest chapters that we've got today. The Lord said to me, go and show your love again to your wife, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So I bought her with 15 shekels of silver and bought a homer with a lethet of barley. And then I told her, you are to live with me for many days and you must not prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way to you. As we return to this picture of Hosea's family, this prophetic picture that the Lord is showing us about his relationship with his people, after showing us this marriage and adulterous wife, Hosea is now enacting and illustrating God's grace. He is to love her as the Lord loves the Israelites. Hosea's love for Gomer, despite her unfaithfulness, shows a mirror of God's love for his people, despite their unfaithfulness. Just by the way, in case it's caught your eye and you're wondering, raisin cakes were probably most likely used in the worship of Baal. As they were used to offer them to him and to eat them, the worshippers would eat them as a sign of fertility. And so what they're saying is they'd prefer to worship Baal and eat these delicious raisin cakes than they would prefer to worship God, who gave them the grain and the wine and the oil and everything that they need. But Hosea obediently did what God had asked again. And he enacts God's love and grace through redeeming his wife and showing that the price must be paid for this relationship to be restored is the price paid by the husband who has been wronged. After he redeems Gomer, he restores her, and there's a recommitment of their marriage, not just on Gomer's side, but on Hosea's as well. Not implying that Hosea has actually ever been unfaithful, but highlighting that actually in a marriage, faithfulness needs to be on both sides. Hosea and God continue to be faithful. What does Hosea's redemption of Gomer show us? He loves her. He redeems her and he restores her. All a pattern to show us God's redemption of his people, who he loves and redeems and restores. There's a marriage, an adultery, and a reconciliation. There's a covenant, idolatry, and a reconciliation. I wonder what this picture of Hosea's redeeming Gomer makes you feel. Does it make you feel relieved? Does it actually make you feel angry? Does it make you feel sad or a sense of injustice? Or is it just not quite sitting right yet? This picture of reconciliation, although shocking, isn't completely unsurprising because we know the character of God and because we've seen the character of God again and again. In Exodus 34, God reveals himself to Moses and he calls himself the Lord, the compassionate and the gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in love and faithfulness and maintaining love to the thousands and forgiving wickedness and sin and rebellion. This is the character of God. And in fact, as Aileen read, you might have noticed there was hope scattered, just sprinkled all the way along, wasn't there? In chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, it says, "In the place where it is said to them, 'You are not my people,' they will be called again children of the living God." One little scatter for us. In chapter 2, 23, it says, "I will show my love to the one I called not my loved. And I will say to those not my people, 'You are my people.' And they will say, 'You are my God.'" Another scattering of reconciliation. And in chapter 3, verse 5, "After the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord, the King David, they will come trembling, and the Lord in his goodness will in the last days." The prophetic picture that God is showing us is an intentional picture, a marriage, an adulterous wife, and a reconciliation to help us understand this relationship with God and his people, a covenant, an idolatrous people, and a reconciliation. This is what God's whole salvation plan has been leading to, a relationship with his people without sin. And I wonder, as we've been reading this and as we've been digging into this and zooming in, I wonder whose eyes you've been picturing this through. Who have you been identifying with as we've listened to this picture of this family that God has given us? With Hosea or with Gomer? I think when I read this, I instinctively identify with Hosea. I feel his hurt and I feel the cost of forgiveness that he has to give to redeem his wife. It gets me right in the guts. And when I do this, I actually often forget that I'm putting myself in the place of God here. That this is what I'm feeling is actually the feelings of God. This prophetic picture is showing us God's relationship with his people. Hosea is representing God and Gomer is representing the people. I'm the people. And I forget so easily. God is the loving husband that has been wronged and Gomer is representing me, the unfaithful, wandering wife who seeks after others to bring her joy and love and security, who's ungrateful for the gifts that God has given and actually breaks the relationship. Hosea is showing us that God is a redeeming God. And this gritty, intimate picture that we see here in the prophet Hosea and his marriage, what he is asked to demonstrate, it only helps us to see more clearly our God and what he has done for us. It helps us to see that sin not only breaks our relationship with God or God's laws, but in fact it breaks God's own heart. And to see that God redeems his unfaithful people because his love is so big and so strong, and his unrelenting desire to be in a relationship with him, with them, will not let him let them go. We couldn't see this more clearly than when we look ahead of Hosea to the cross. When we look ahead and we see Jesus. Romans 5 verse 10, it's Romans 5 verse 6 to 10 says, "At just the right time, while we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely would anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were sinners, Christ died for us. Since we have been now justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if, while we were God's enemies, we are reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, have been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life?" How are we to respond to this? How is the relationship status of God and his people seen? Lovingly redeemed is a really good description. Through Hosea's own experiences, we can see God's experience with his people. We are given and invited, in fact, to empathize with Hosea and to share his pain so that we can see God's pain and God's cost to redeem. We have treated God as Gomer has treated Hosea. And God does not respond to us as we deserve, but again, he shows his love to us and buys us back through his son Jesus and restores us to him. I wonder, in this picture of God and his people, how this makes you feel. Do you see God as a loving, redeeming husband? Do you see yourself as an unfaithful Gomer? Do you see your sin as breaking that relationship with God and breaking God's heart? And do you see God demonstrates his own love for this, that while you were still sinners, Christ died for us? The book of Hosea starts off with this prophetic picture of God's relationship with his people. In our next two talks, we're going to look richer at the description and the consequences of this relationship, of how God's justice brings judgment and how his mercy brings love. But we need to understand this first picture. We need to understand and to see what God is trying to show us about the relationship with his people. I think I neglect to see that God is a wronged husband. I neglect to see that unfaithfulness and sin hurts him personally and breaks his heart. I'm actually much quicker to recognize that my sin will be judged and that my sin rightfully makes God angry, or that my sin breaks my relationship with God. I'm happy to see that my sin needs forgiving, but I neglect to see this gritty, intimate side of my sin, that like a wronged husband, it hurts God. I need this picture here today in Hosea. I think we all need this picture here in Hosea to see the God who we have and the God who redeems us. Shall we?